was even alive. I thought about it all. The times I spent with him. The times I spent without him. The joy he brought me. The pain. All that fucking pain. I thought about what I would do without him. What if the next time I lost him, it was forever? I thought about his mortality and mine and how short life can be. I thought about love and its truest definitions, its emotion, its actions, the crazy shit it made us do and say. I paced and I thought. I cried. I drank more. I waited for Wayne to tell me he was okay. I waited. And waited. I'm okay, Mama. Sorry I scared you. I love you. The text read when it came in 2 hours later. I exhaled for the first time that morning. Don't be sorry, baby. As long as you're okay, I'm okay. I love you too. Wayne and I texted each other back and forth for the better part of an hour that day and every single day after. He experienced another seizure just days later, and I relived my fears all over again, scrambling to get word from inside his camp, waiting for him to tell me he was okay. He never let a day go by after the episodes without saying I love you. Not a day went by when I didn't check in on him, and he didn't check in on me. His seizures and the fears and realizations they caused brought us closer. Wayne was always the picture of strength to me. He was my strength. He was part of the reason I was happy and healthy again. He was the reason I'd been able to walk away from Aaron and had no intention of settling for Nigel or anyone else beneath my worth. He was the reason I began to eat again, to fill out my genes and love my body. He made me feel beautiful. He reminded me of who I was and who I was always meant to be. A part of me lived in him, and without him, that part dies. It was Wayne and his seizures that cracked the ice atop the frozen pool of pent-up anguish and emotion I'd been storing for the past 5 years. I began to fear and worry about what my life would be like without him. God forbid if something horrible were to happen to him or to me, who would know the truth about us and the love we shared and the heated battles of falling apart and the coming together? As a writer, as a woman who built her entire life on the telling of truths and the leaving behind of proof of life, I feared either one of us leaving this earth, never having left behind a footprint of our love. Something was stirring inside me. I wanted to write it all down. Still, I could not. Not yet. Chapter 23. Loser. Wayne's health continued to be touch and go for the rest of October, into November and beyond. I grew closer to him in that time, and my love for him continued to grow, as did my love for Taj. I was disturbed by the feelings I had for Taj, and how they seemed to be competing with my feelings for Wayne. It was Taj's mind. It was the conversations we had late at night, and the time we spent together that fall. We were incredible. There was a cerebral bond being built and strengthened with each encounter, and I found his intelligence incredibly sexy and alluring. Plus, Taj continued to inspire me as I watched him work on project after project, writing, sketching, and designing things, creating images and products for clients around the clock. As an artist, there was very little he could do, and he made me want to create. Yet, my block remained. I was still being weighed down by my inability to find a place to live and by my debt. I was running out of time and money once again and was continuing to keep my circumstances a secret from most everyone I knew. Taj knew I was living at the hotel, but I insisted I was only there while waiting for my apartment to become available and assured him Naeem and I would be moving into our new place before Thanksgiving. It wasn't really a lie. Taj was living with a friend and colleague at the time, not having his own place either, and I think he understood being displaced. Taj described our relationship as the coming together of lines in a square, bursting with emotion at each sharp point. We were feverish with each other. We were passionate when in each other's arms, when talking about art, theories, and concepts. We were equally as passionate when we argued, and in the span of our short relationship, we found ourselves in quite a few arguments. They were always explosive, but none of our rifts was as explosive as the one we had in early November. As intense as it was, however, I can't remember what the argument was about, as is the case most times we find ourselves arguing with people we love about things that don't matter. But both Taj and I were temperamental and often push one another's buttons as we each struggle to find a place for one another in our already complicated lives. Our rage flared as we argued. I sat on the edge of the bed in my hotel room, screaming at him over the phone and listening to him scream at me. And then he said the worst thing anyone has ever said to me and at the worst time. "You're such a fucking loser, you know that? You are a loser. You think you're so special and so important. Why? Because you wrote a book? You're nothing but a joke and a fucking loser." Tar screamed on the other end of the phone, my mouth agape. And as I listened to him continue to berate me, I could feel my light being blown out. Whatever I had left, whatever gumption or hope or spirit I had left after all I'd been through, was stolen from me in that moment, and there was nothing I could say. There was no comeback. There was no rebuttal. There was no more fight. Wounded and dying, I very softly said, "Okay, Taj, I think it's time we get off the phone," and hung up. The tears streamed from my eyes as I made no sound. They flowed effortlessly and dripped onto my shirt as I turned my phone off and tucked it between the mattress and the box spring. I walked slowly to the light switch on the wall next to the hotel room's door and flipped it off, then turned out the light on the desk right next to the bed. Sobbing, I crawled under the covers and just lay there. I couldn't speak. I could barely breathe. There was no one I wanted to talk to and nowhere I wanted to go. I just wanted to be still. So I lay there for the rest of that day and for 10 more days after that. Taj had deeply wounded me at a time when I already felt like a loser. I couldn't find my passion to write or a publisher who believed in me. I couldn't find a place to live. I was living hand to mouth and had been depending on a man, Bruce, who I believed would only help me in exchange for sexual favors. I was homeless and my son was silently suffering from my instability. I was doing everything I could to stay afloat, living in survival mode, leaning on my instincts and praying to God, trusting him and trying not to panic. I was already down, and this is when Taj kicked me in the very rib he gave me. Any inspiration I garnered from him left me like my last breath. I lay there catatonic for 10 days, getting up to prepare food and maybe run to the store for supplies, but never with a light heart or a smile on my face. Every move I made was labored, and the only thing that felt right was lying down and being very, very still. Every day I cried and tried to hide my sorrows by doing so in the bathroom of our tiny hotel room. I relied on pillows to stifle the sound of my wails as Naeem spent most of his time on his laptop with his headphones on, watching movies or playing games online. And I prayed. A lot. I was learning so much about myself during this ordeal. I was learning to talk to God more and to trust him without fear or doubt. I was learning about the decline of the respect I once had for myself and the respect others had for me, especially the men in my life. I was learning about my resilience and weaknesses. I stayed inside my head for those 10 days, thinking about how I got there, to that hotel and to that place in my life. I thought about the choices I made And I thought back to that day in July 2007 when I decided to ignore everything I heard about Aaron and the red flags I saw for myself. I thought about the many chances I had to get out of my relationship with him and how I forced him into my life even though God was so plainly showing me he was not the one. I thought about my obsession with normalcy, family, and how it all must seem to the people on the outside looking in. I reviewed everything. It was as if my life was flashing before my eyes as I lay there, catatonic, a shell of who I used to be, getting closer to who I would become. I saw scenes from my life over the past 5 years, and each of them had one common denominator: me. I was at the center of all of it, allowing certain people into my life, ignoring certain things, and making up other things in my head. I created my own private hell and then perished in its flames. And on the 10th day, I got out of bed and was reborn. I jumped up that morning and showered for the first time in days. I opened the window, turned on the lights, played a bit of music, and made breakfast. I was filled with energy and hope, and most importantly, passion. Naeem and I got into the car and headed out to his weekly music class and band rehearsals. Even during the chaos, I tried my best to retain some sort of normalcy and routine for him. I drove down the main drag with music blaring, singing along. Then I saw something familiar. A shape on the side of the road, a person standing next to his car talking on the phone. Naeem saw him too and smiled. Just as we passed by, his eyes caught ours. It was Taj. We hadn't spoken or texted since our fight, and I would have figured that the next time I saw him, I'd be overwrought with disgust and anger, but I wasn't. The sight of him made my eyes light up and coaxed a smile bigger than my face could carry. I loved him. I loved him no matter what he said or did, and it surprised me. Quickly, I reached for my phone and called him. "Hey, I just saw you guys," he said as he answered the phone. "Yeah, you saw us?" I asked, still grinning. "I saw Naeem first and his big smile, then I saw you. Where are you guys going?" "I'm taking Naeem to class and rehearsals." "Okay, well, hit me when you get back to this side of town."
"I will. It was good to see you."
"Good to see you too."
There was just something about Taj and my relationship with him, something that had begun the very first day we spent together. I already loved him more than I could ever be mad at him, and no matter how much he hurt me, that love wouldn't change. Until I met Taj, the only man I loved this unconditionally was Wayne. It frightened me to love someone else so completely, as well as warmed my heart to know I could. After all I'd been through, I wasn't broken. It was no coincidence that I met Taj that night at the steakhouse, or that he found and contacted me just days after I settled into the hotel. It wasn't happenstance that he moved out of his place and wound up in the same suburban neighborhood Naeem and I wound up in at the exact same time, about 45 minutes from where either of us had been living before. And now, it wasn't a coincidence that he happened to be standing outside a restaurant, talking on his phone, waiting for his food, just when I passed by after 10 days of solitude. Taj and I were being drawn toward one another, and there was nothing we could do about it. That morning, I woke up feeling good, but after talking to him, I felt even better. There was no animosity between us, and that just fueled my newly rediscovered passion further. Wayne's illness had stirred my emotions, Taj's creativity had ignited mine, and Taj's harsh words had temporarily broken my spirit, but in those 10 days since, I had become stronger in the broken places. Taj built me up just to break me down, and the straw that broke my back and sent me into a catatonic state soon served as kindling. My passion would finally catch fire.
Chapter 24. Mercy. By the next morning, I knew just what to do.
I went to the grocery store for a six-pack of Japanese beer, came back to the room, and sat at the desk. I opened my laptop and a bottle of beer, plugged in my headphones, pressed play on a playlist filled with Wayne's songs, and began to write. How to Make Love to a Martian was born in that cramped hotel room in the middle of a series of crises at a time when I had no idea what the future held for me. With all that was swirling around, the rejection, the wandering, the instability of my life and relationships, I honed in on the one person I feared losing the most. Wayne. The idea of someone you love being sick and the possibility of them dying today or any day somehow manages to override any fear, worry, or doubt you may feel for yourself. My heart was filled, not with sorrow for my own circumstances, but with love and appreciation for Wayne, now more than ever, and I had to write it down. I had to leave it behind for someone to read, so others would know that Wayne and I were here and that we loved. Ironically, it was the hateful words of my other lover that broke my writer's block and sent me on this journey to recap my 5.5-year relationship with Wayne. The words poured out as the music played. I couldn't stop my fingers from hitting the keys at 80 words a minute. I entered a zone, a parallel place in my mind. I stared at the screen, barely ever looking down at my keyboard. I was writing for the first time in 4 years, and I didn't want it to stop. I was obsessed with the book for 3 days, almost forgetting the world around me until I received a call from David, the manager of an apartment property about which I'd inquired online. It was the only thing that could make me stop writing. I made an appointment to see an available unit in David's building the following day. It was about 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, and I promised my son we would have a place to live before the holidays. I prayed to God and begged him to help us find a home by then, and I never doubted it would happen, being careful not to override my faith with fear, just as Deneen taught me. I wanted God to know I trusted him and no longer wanted to fight his will. From that point on, I only wanted what was best for me. So I kept my spirits high and my faith higher. The small courtyard-style apartment building was perfect. As David and I entered the breezeway on our way to the unit, I was overwhelmed by a feeling of peace and tranquility. Lush gardens and bubbling fountains calmed me instantly. The suburban location of the building was just what I needed, and the price of the unit was spot on. There was nothing about the building or the unit that didn't fit my hopes or expectations. So despite my poor credit and recent eviction, I confidently filled out an application. David ran my credit and checked my references. I kept a good relationship with one of the managers of my prior apartment complex. Though I'd broken my lease, she didn't know why, and I'd cited my reason for leaving as the recent flea and roach infestation in my unit that had gone unchecked. So she gave me a good reference. My credit wasn't the best, but David overlooked that and focused instead on the six-figure income I made the year before and claimed on my taxes. I waited on pins and needles for days, working to get David everything he needed to fulfill my application. Then, just 1 week before Thanksgiving, my application was approved. But there was just one problem. I was already nearly out of money again. I gave David the $500 deposit and still had to write a check for $1,900 more by my move-in date. Then there was the cost of the movers, the closing bill for my storage unit, and the money I had to pay to turn on the utilities. I needed help. So, begrudgingly, and out of other options, I called Bruce. "I think I'm going to get a hotel room at the Intercontinental. Want to meet me there?" Bruce proposed. He never came right out and said what he was doing. He always beat around the bush and acted as if what was going on between us was something other than what it was. I really just wanted him to say, "Oh, you need money? Cool, come fuck me and I'll give it to you." But the nature of our relationship wasn't something I think he wanted to admit or even say out loud. Some people are too ashamed to admit what they do, but not enough to stop doing it. This time, however, I had a trick up my sleeve. Naturally, I wouldn't leave Naeem alone in the hotel to go pick up the money from Bruce at another hotel way across town. What loving mother would? So, he and I piled into the car and made the trek across town in rush hour traffic. It took us nearly 2 hours to get there. On the way, Bruce continuously called to check on my progress, and I alerted him I was inching ever closer, never mentioning I was with Naeem. I pulled into the hotel's drive, and as the valet opened my car door, I assured him, "You can leave it here. I'm just picking up a package, and I won't be long." Naeem and I made our way through the hotel's lobby, into the elevator, and to Bruce's room. I knocked lightly, and as Bruce answered the door, his eyes opened wide to find me standing there with my son. I smirked. "I can't stay long," I said as we entered the room. "Valet is holding my car, and Naeem needs to get to bed." Naeem stayed close to the door, his intuition telling him Bruce was up to no good with his mother. "Come on in, Naeem, have a seat," Bruce said. "I'm good," Naeem insisted. "Yeah, I wasn't about to leave him in the hotel by himself. It's a derelict hotel with all sorts of questionable people coming in and out of there. It wouldn't be right," I explained, still smirking. I had him between a rock and a hard place. If he refused to give me the money now, he would essentially be admitting that our relationship was based solely on sex, and that if he couldn't have sex with me, he wouldn't help me in front of my son. And he couldn't very well demand I have sex with him when my son was in the other room. Naeem and I only stayed for a few minutes as Bruce peeled $2,000 from a large stack of $100 bills and handed it to me. I knew this wouldn't be the last time I had to deal with Bruce, but at least for the moment, he wouldn't be allowed to take advantage of me. Back in the elevator, as Naeem and I headed back down to valet, I smiled. I hadn't won the war, but this small victory was mine. I didn't have to break my promise to Naeem. He and I moved into our new apartment the day before Thanksgiving. It seemed as if my luck was beginning to take a turn for the better. Still, I was far from fully recovered from the damage done over the past 5.5 years. Now that Naeem and I were in our new place, I had to fight hard to keep it. And since I was still receiving rejections from the nearly 30 publishers to which I submitted book proposals, I would still need Bruce to help me survive. Even though my writer's block had lifted and I was in the middle of writing How to Make Love to a Martian, it wasn't a book I wanted to sell to a publisher to have printed and promoted around the world. Martian was a very intimate personal project, and though I wanted to share it with my fans and Wayne's, I didn't want to profit greatly from it, especially at a time when his health was so delicate. Instead, I was submitting something less personal. Not every publisher turned me down outright. There were a few who may not have wanted to publish the safe and practical relationship guide I submitted, but who were sure to respond with requests for what they really wanted from me. As one publisher asked, "Can she submit a list of men?" A list of men. There I was, having fought for my life for over 5.5 years, having been dragged through the mud by an abusive husband, having fallen apart at the seams, starved myself and struggled to break free, and when it finally seemed there may be a way out from under the rubble of what used to be my life, I was being asked for a list of men. What kind of list did they want? A list of the cab drivers I'd met during my travels? Or maybe they wanted a list of all the waiters and maitre d's that had filled my empty wine glasses over the years? My gardener, pool man, gynecologist? What exactly were they asking me? My agent tried his best to make the request seem less insulting than it was, but it was clear. The gossip and rumors that had been swirling around about me for the past handful of years were affecting my ability to work. I wanted to write about something real, something true to my life and important to me. I was no longer a 20-something with a long history to tell. I was well into my 30s, a divorcee, a single mother, a woman who had lost everything she worked so hard to achieve, a domestic abuse survivor, and now a starving author dying to work. I could have sold out and given in to what those publishers wanted from me, but I figured I'd done that before. From the very beginning, I'd given my publishers and even a sector of my readers what they wanted, going against everything I wanted for my life and career. Confessions wasn't meant to be my first book. I was pitching the Vixen Manual. I didn't want to write the Vixen Diaries. I was still rooting for the Vixen Manual. And with Diaries, I felt forced to reveal the name of the character in Confessions, known as Papa, after my editor threatened I'd have to return the $250,000 advance if I didn't. Then there was Satisfaction, the book I had nothing to do with. I hated the topic, the title and subtitle, and the cover, and I didn't even write it. So much of my career had been built on what other people wanted from me. And at the end of it all, I was the only one who'd lost. Everything had been so contrived and choreographed. There were dozens of people with their hands in my books, making decisions without me, and my writing had become less about me and more about satisfying the machine. I was determined to move forward in my career and to rebuild my life, but do so with integrity and by writing only about the things that were important to me, staying true to my art and to myself. So I turned down those publishers who wanted this phantom list of men they thought I'd been collecting over the years. As I grew older, I grew wiser, and my relationships became more substantial. Though I wasn't living the sort of wild, sex-crazed life the public imagined, I did have very important people in my life that I wanted to protect. My private life actually became private. Still, there had to be something I was willing to write that would interest a publisher. All I needed was one. In the meantime, I continued to depend on Bruce, humbling myself to his possessive, demeaning treatment of me. By December 2012, just 3 months after my residual checks had come in and 3 months until the next ones would arrive, I was completely out of money and was back leaning on Bruce to help me with rent, groceries, and monthly bills. On the 3rd of December, he asked if I needed help, and I admitted I did before he agreed to take care of my monthly expenses. Days went by, and then weeks. Soon, it was the 26th of the month, and my new landlord was growing increasingly impatient. I called and texted Bruce for 3 weeks straight, but he never responded. This was his usual game, to offer help and then keep me waiting, begging for money. I was practicing faith and patience and praying, but by the end of the month, I had enough with the psychological and financial abuse. If Bruce really wanted to help me, he should have done so by then and not had me waiting and begging for weeks. Fed up, I sent him a text message. I've been calling you for 3 weeks and I haven't heard from you. You offered to help me and then disappeared. No matter how badly I need the help, I'm not going to continue to beg for it. Either you're going to do it or you're not, but don't have me depending on you all this time if you're not going to come through. I could have been working on another way to get it done instead of trying to track you down for almost a month. It didn't take long for Bruce to respond. After not hearing from him in all that time, it took exactly one irate text message to get him to answer me. He called my phone right away, and as I answered, all I could hear was yelling. We bantered back and forth for several minutes, pleading our cases. Whatever he was saying went in one ear and out the other, and his words were quickly forgotten, except for a few. How do I know you're not going to do the same shit you did to me at my other apartment? You knew I needed the rent, and you knew how much I needed, and you promised you would help me, but you purposely shorted me. That's how I wound up getting evicted, and now this! Now you want me to fucking beg for the help you offered me? How much of this shit do you expect me to take? I yelled, tears streaming down my cheeks. Well, I wasn't about to pay for some other motherfucker to lay his head in your apartment, and what you need to realize is that sometimes you have to beg for what you want when you're at someone else's mercy, Bruce responded sternly. And there it was. Finally, Bruce admitted that he shorted me on purpose. In that moment, he proved how much pleasure he got from dismantling my life and from my begging for his help. His words rang in my ears, playing themselves back over and over again. This was it. This was where it had all led me. Silently, I vowed to never forget those words and to hold them against Bruce always. But that was not the moment to buck against him. I needed his money too much. So I grit my teeth, bore the abuse, and did whatever it took to take care of my son and me. Chapter 25. Do the Work. Naeem and I made it through the holidays and the new year, though there was no real celebration, no Christmas tree, no gifts. And when his 15th birthday came around in mid-January, there just wasn't enough money to celebrate. Bruce was only handling the basics and using my body up in the process. He was still with his fiancée, who lived in another state and had a personal life of her own. Everyone who witnessed their relationship knew it was a sham, and I picked up the slack, doing all the things a girlfriend or fiancé would. Being there for him all hours of the day and night, listening to him gripe, supporting his career moves, staying up late nights watching television and joking around. Bruce continued to talk about our relationship as if it were so magical and heartwarming, and I wondered if he thought he was buying my affections. I fucking hated him for the way he treated me, and the power he exacted because of his ability to help me through one of the roughest periods of my life. I vowed to work even harder and looked forward to the day I would be free of him, just as I'd gotten free from Aaron. The winter and spring of 2013 were somewhat uneventful. I continued to struggle a bit in the beginning. I entered into an option continuation deal with Fox Television Studios for Confessions and kept myself afloat by self-publishing How to Make Love to a Martian in February. Priced at only $2.99, the project wasn't something I was trying to get rich from, and I turned down most interview requests about it. I really just wanted to create something that was completely mine, a book that hadn't been rifled through by editors and influenced by a publishing conglomerate, and I wanted to make a moderate amount of money to hold me until I could find the right book and the right publisher. I wasn't trying to be greedy. I just wanted to be fair. Besides, I was happy just to have broken through my writer's block, knowing that, having done so, I could write anything else I wanted as soon as I knew what that should be. Over the first half of 2013, I did everything I could to support myself and need Bruce less and less until I didn't need him at all. Between proceeds from Martian and payments from Fox and my ever-faithful residual checks, I was able to take care of myself more often than not. By the summer, I was feeling like myself again and started hanging out with friends for the first time in years. I spent most of the summer poolside, eating and drinking and dancing. I was healthy and less stressed and I was coming alive again. Gone were the days of eating disorders, loneliness, and sadness. I was enjoying life with fewer financial woes. I was silly and lighthearted and laughing more than I had in years. That May, my divorce from Nigel became final after more than a year of confusion, missed filings, and incomplete paperwork. He and I managed to stay in contact while working our way through the blunder-filled proceedings. Eventually, he hired an attorney who, after a few blunders of her own, brought us before a judge for the final stamp of approval. The process couldn't have been messier if the Three Stooges had handled it, but it was all done that summer, and I was finally free. Taj and I continued to see each other and grew closer, forming a bond that had become unbreakable. I watched him build a company and a brand with such passion that the feeling was infectious. I became obsessed with building a brand of my own, only just then realizing that having a slew of products didn't mean I had a brand. I dove into business books and magazines. I paid close attention to the backstories of successful people, brands, and companies, and I thought long and hard about what I wanted for myself. I thought about the mistakes I made in my personal and professional life and found that I could have avoided nearly a decade of heartbreak if, In making any decision, I would have asked myself just one question. And then what? I had gone about life never asking myself about the future, never thinking about the consequences before making decisions. If I would have only asked myself, and then what? Everything could have been different. So by the fall of 2013, I was determined to make every decision count and not take one step before asking myself, and then what? With Taj as a major motivator, I began building my brand, doing so based on the things that interested me and not necessarily based on what interested a portion of my audience. I wanted to build something that would be easy to maintain because it was organic, true to who I am. I wanted to finally show people what my real interests were and what my actual quality of life was. So I began developing the Corinne & Company brand and its subsidiaries, planning a long-term strategy and outlook for each company. I spent plenty of nights burning the midnight oil, much the way I saw Taj do when I was with him. I mimicked his drive and was inspired every time I watched him work or talked with him about his work, and my drive was often influenced by his. I was working harder than I had in years, and it felt good. Still, there was just one thing missing, one very important thing, the perfect book. With 2014 just months away, it dawned on me that in less than 2 years, Confessions of a Video Vixen would be 10 years old, and I felt as if that book deserved to be commemorated. Confessions had changed my life and afforded me everything I ever dreamed of as a child. It had taken me around the world and launched a career and far-reaching recognition. To this day, I still reap its rewards. Once I realized the 10th year was fast approaching, I knew the next book and deal had to be commemorative. I contacted my representatives, told them the plan, and prepared the proposal for the book you're reading right now. Within weeks, the new proposal was sent out to tens of agents, and I waited anxiously for their replies, fingers crossed. Many denied it. A few wanted that fabled list of men, but there were biters. And for the first time in over 4 years, there were publishing offers on the table and all I had to do was choose. And I did. As I slowly began putting the pieces of my life back together, I never forgot the horrible things Bruce and Taj said to me. I never forgot what it felt like to be called a loser and to be told I had to beg because I was at someone else's mercy. I constantly reminded myself what it felt like to not be in control of my life and instead be at the mercy of men. I kept in mind the decisions I made back in 2007 and how choosing to be with Aaron had cast a dark shadow over my life for all those years. I thought about all I lost and all I gave away, realizing I'd always had the power to change my life but had chosen to relinquish it. I knew I wouldn't be making that choice again. In October 2013, I was on the precipice of signing my first book deal in 4 years and looking forward to the year ahead. My relationship with Wayne was the same it had always been, with its highs and lows, falling outs and coming togethers, but we were stronger than ever. I was still in love with him after everything. My relationship with Taj was blossoming and we were finally to the point where we could admit we loved each other and wanted to be in each other's lives for the long haul. I loved him differently than I loved Wayne, but just as unconditionally. My relationship with Bruce changed as I gained more independence. I continued to loathe him but wanted to keep him around long enough for him to witness me get back on my feet without him. But the strongest relationships in my life were those with my son, my God, and myself. Together, we made it through one of the most trying times of my life, and we were closer than ever. It was important that my son see his mother pull it together, gather her resources, and make it happen for us again. I wanted him to know that I'm not perfect, that I make mistakes, but that I can also make them right. I wanted him to know that I would not be making the same mistakes twice, not anymore. We were moving forward and we were not going to miss out on life again. So that October, I signed a new publishing contract and officially started my life over one more time. I was happy. I was elated. I was walking on fucking air. I was having more meaningful relationships. I was stabilizing financially. I was looking and feeling better than I had in years, and I just signed a lucrative deal that was sure to put me back on my feet for the long run. I was able to pay back family members and friends who sent me money during my hard times, and I was able to continue avoiding Bruce's sexual advances. It was the happiest I'd been since 2007. I was glowing and apparently giving off a radiance that could be felt for miles because, in mid-December, Aaron came lurking, no doubt having seen a blip of my joy on his seek and destroy radar. Chapter 26. Apropos. It was around December 15th, 2013, when I received a cryptic email from my first ex-husband. It read, "I need to talk to you before both of us make a mistake we can't take back." Instantly, I knew what Aaron was up to. It was the same shit he'd always did, that radar he had that sent him into attack mode, never wanting to see me happy. For a few days, we played phone tag and then, on December 19th, made plans to meet for brunch at a restaurant near my apartment, a place we'd frequented often when we were married. I went into the situation quite snide, as I was in the midst of preparing to leave town with Taj in a few days. He and I were in a really great place, and this would be our first trip together to spend time with his friends and family. Floating on a cloud, I made my way to the restaurant as slowly as I could and arrived about 15 minutes late, even though the eatery was just 2 minutes from my place. Aaron had arrived on time and waited for me. Before leaving the apartment, I preened. I wanted to be sure to look my very best. I wore a form-fitting outfit and 5-inch heels. I did my makeup and perfected my hair. I wanted to stun my ex-husband. I wanted him to see I was not only okay, but thriving, that I was happy, healthy, and gorgeous without him. I walked into the restaurant and scanned the room, finding him as he stood up, his 6-foot-4-inch frame towering. I gave a half smile and made my way over to him, greeting him with a one-handed hug and a lazy hello. We sat across from each other in a booth and made the usual pleasant conversation for the first few minutes. "You look beautiful," Aaron stated. "Thank you. You look like shit. I can tell you haven't been sleeping," I responded with a smirk. "Your skin looks good, though. You've been in the steam room, huh?" "Yeah, I was just in the steam room yesterday. And it's hard to sleep these days."
"Oh yeah? Why is that?"
"I'm not happy, Corinne."
Just then, the waitress came by. "Hi there, you two ready to order?"
Completely unmoved by Aaron's admittance of unhappiness, I ordered a large breakfast and a mimosa. I was starving, and something told me I was going to need to be tipsy for this conversation. Aaron ordered his food, and as the waitress walked away, he continued.
"You were right. The way you had it all set up before, the way you took care of the kids, the house, and me was all right. I just couldn't see it then. I want it all back."
"You want what back?" I asked, already knowing the answer.
"I want you back. I want the regimen you had in place. I want to go to bed early and turn off the phone for family time. I want to go to church and brunch on Sundays and not run around town taking meetings that amount to nothing, just like you always insisted."
"Really? What brought this on?"
"I'm just not happy, babe, and I want my wife back. I need you to fix my life."
"Fix your life? What's wrong with your life?" I asked as our food was delivered to the table.
"I'll need another mimosa," I said to our waitress. "Things are just out of control, and they were never like this when we were together."
"Yeah, because I was a good wife who took complete care of you, your son, our home, and everything else. But you didn't appreciate any of it. You didn't want to be there. You didn't want to be told what to do or to be regimented. That's what you said back then, so don't change your fucking song now," I insisted, a sarcastic tone in my voice.
"I know, I know.
You wanted to let your mother run your life instead, so go let your mother fix your life."
"I don't really talk to my mother anymore. I know she came in between us and our relationship and ruined a lot of things for me and for us, but she's not around as much. She moved into a new place and finally got her own life.
He was trying to entice me. He thought he was saying what I wanted to hear.
Enough about that. How's Jonah? He's good. He's in Chicago with his mother.
Oh, good. He's there for the holidays?
Yeah, well, he's out there for good, at least for now.
For good? The judge finally granted her custody?
Yeah, but I'm fighting it.
After 6 years of a heated court battle, after all Aaron's lies, antics, and deceptions, Jonah's mother was finally able to regain custody of her son after a Chicago court found him unfit. I nodded my head, but smiled on the inside, thinking about when Aaron tried to have my son taken away from me, knowing his chickens had come home to roost.
Well, good for him. Every child deserves to be with his mother. I mean, she has a house and a husband, and they have 4 or 5 other children between them, so he's with his family, and he's stable now. I would have never lost him if I was still with you, though.
This is true. But you fucked that all up. You had a wife and a stable home, you had 2 kids, and all the love and support in the world. But you wanted to do what you wanted to do. You wanted to be gone days, weeks, and months at a time.
I was never gone for months.
Aaron, I continued, putting down my fork and looking him square in the eyes. You were gone for 7 months one time, and you don't remember half the shit you did or the damage you caused because you and I were in 2 different relationships. You got to fuck shit up and just walk away, and I was left to try to pick up all the fucking pieces to repair the broken spirits and emotional gashes you left behind. Then whenever you got tired or bored or thought for 1 second I might be moving on, you came back to fuck shit up again. You had everything and you ruined it. You fucked up your life and you have to be okay with that now. I will never come back to you. You were my biggest mistake and the worst thing that ever happened to me. And I'm sorry to hear you're so unhappy, but that's your fault. And as for me, I am happier without you. In fact, I've never been so happy. And I'm sitting here listening to you, and all you have done for the past hour is tell me all the things I can do for you. You have never once offered to do anything for me. You've just come back around here to take, to bleed me dry, to finish me off. You haven't once asked about me, how I'm doing, because you don't even care. My tone was serious, but my voice remained low and calm. I was in control. I was confident and secure, and for the past 15 months, had never once regretted my decision to leave Aaron behind.
I do care, babe. That's why I wanted to talk to you. I mean, there were lots of good times, and all you choose to remember are the bad times. We were happy. We were in love. And I can't imagine starting my life over with someone else. This woman I'm seeing now wants to get married and have kids, and I'd rather do those things with you. I figured it was time we gave it another chance.
I think you should stay with your new girlfriend and marry her and have kids with her. I'm sure she deserves you more than I do, I responded, laughing at his attempt to make me feel as if I'd better jump on his offer before someone else snatched him up. I giggled like a child as I asked, how long have you been dating this person?
About 2 months.
I fucking roared. My mimosa almost came through my nose. I laughed so hard. Child, you should marry that girl you've known for 2 months and go live happily ever after.
But I'd rather be with you.
Yeah, I bet. But I'm not the same girl you used to know. Besides, you haven't even thought to ask me what's going on with me, if I'm in a relationship or not. As usual, you're just assuming I've been sitting around fucking waiting for you to come back into my life. My laughter was uncontrollable. I couldn't take it anymore. He was being too ridiculous. Aaron looked at me blankly, searching for his next line, his next lie. He was still the same man, the same abuser, trying to fool me into falling into the pit with him again. This time, he'd lost everything. The year before, he'd been cast on a popular sitcom, but the character soon played out, and Aaron found himself working less and less. To make matters worse for him, he had lost custody of Jonah. Plus, he looked like shit. He was exactly where he deserved to be. And so was I. Well, this has been lovely, but I have to go. I still have some shopping to do before my boyfriend and I leave town in a few days, I said, trying to end the date.
Oh, you have a boyfriend?
Yeah, and you would have known that an hour ago if you'd have ever asked anything about me and my life. We've been together over a year. Anyway, good luck with your relationship. I hope that works out for you. We rose from our seats and walked out of the restaurant to the parking lot and stood next to my new car, just two spaces away from his dinged and dated vehicle.
Well, maybe we can continue to talk. We can build and start over slowly. Nothing's wrong with that, right?
Aaron questioned. He was still looking for a way in.
Sure, email me, I responded, one foot already in my car.
Aren't you going to give me a hug goodbye?
Ugh. Okay, I whined as I stepped in front of him and gave him another one-handed hug and two pats on the back.
Don't fucking pat my back like we were never married.
Sweetie, we weren't.
Oh, yeah?
Aaron said as he leaned in and tried to kiss my lips. I couldn't believe it. He was still trying to lure me into his web with all the same bullshit he gave me in 2007. I moved my face as he chased my lips from side to side, holding me in an embrace.
Stop! I'm not kissing you! You're my wife! Kiss me!
I pushed away from Aaron and said sternly,
I'm not your wife anymore! You divorced me, remember?
And you have to be okay with that, too. Aaron reached into his pocket and tried one more trick, one more last-ditch effort to win my affections. He pulled out a short stack of money and peeled off a few $100s.
Well, here. Maybe I wasn't able to help you out as much as you needed me to, but I can do a little something now.
I took the money.
Thanks.
Buy something for Naeem for Christmas and tell him it's for me.
Will do, I said as I closed my car door and started my vehicle.
Call me later. I love you.
Bye, I yelled out the window as I backed up and sped out of the parking lot, leaving Aaron in my dust. Literally. I shoved the money into my purse and laughed. There was no way I would buy my son a Christmas gift on Aaron's behalf. There was no way I would ever tell my son I even met with Aaron. I wasn't going to infect my kid with so much as a mention of that monster's name, and the fact that Aaron wanted me to was further proof that nothing about him was different. I took the $300 he gave me and went shopping for my trip with Taj. It seemed apropos. Conclusion. The beginning. It's been a wild 10 years since the publication of my first memoir, Confessions of a Video Vixen, but it probably wasn't the sort of wild ride you imagined. Maybe you thought there would be lots of men and sex, drugs, and random regrets in this book. Maybe you thought there'd be tabloid-worthy romps and gross sexual misjudgments or baskets of other people's dirty laundry. Maybe you expected the words in this book to be less important. But I couldn't write about things that didn't happen. With anyone's life, there is always speculation from outsiders and rumors swirling around, others trying to imagine what they think your life is like. But the outsiders are always wrong. Sometimes we can project a perfect picture of strength and resilience, never leading on that we are broken and closing in on our deaths. We all have a persona. People who don't know us, who only see us at work, follow us on social media, or hear of us through conversations with other people who don't know us, gather bits and pieces of information, whether true or false, and use that information to make their minds up about us. They condemn. Sometimes that condemnation even comes from those we know and love, who we thought knew and loved us. All of us want to believe we are different, and that is exactly what makes us all the same. Some people believe they are better than others, and it is that belief that makes them worse. I am not alone, and as I gathered my thoughts to write this book, I struggled with its angle, I struggled with its format, but I did not struggle with its truths. You needed to know this. Those of you who have never been struck, never been choked, never been spit upon and called names you couldn't repeat, you needed to know that this exists and no one is immune. You needed to know what it does to a person. And those of you who have been abused, you needed to know that you are not alone. And in a split second, you can change your life by changing your mind. You all needed to know that one bad decision could ruin your life for years or forever. You needed to know what happened to me. You needed to know you too can make it through. The journey to regain my emotional, financial, and physical footing was a tough one. There was a slew of lessons along the way, all of which I have heeded and all of which I remind myself daily. I no longer desire to make things look good or acceptable to others. I no longer believe I can buy happiness, and I put more stock in the love of God, my son, and those closest to me than in anything else. I live my life peacefully, surrounded by loved ones with good intentions, quickly discarding anyone who tries to abuse my friendship, my love, or me. I have been made better, stronger, and more aware. As for the vixen, she never existed. And what remains after the chewing up and spitting out of my past persona is this. I am a woman, faulty and flawed, but a woman nonetheless. I deserve better than I have accepted in the past, and I deserve all that's amazing in my future. Thank you for spending the past 10 years with me. Thank you for waiting for me to step into my true light and purpose. Thank you for accompanying me all the way to the beginning. This has been an Audible Studios production of Vindicated, Confessions of a Video Vixen 10 Years Later. Written by Corinne Steffens. Narrated by Corinne Steffens. Producer, Mike Charzuk. Copyright 2015 by Corinne Steffens. Production copyright 2015 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.